Again, the next matter is Ortner versus Ortner. Each side will have 15 minutes for presentation of their argument. The appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask each attorney to identify themselves on the record before they begin their presentation. The appellant may begin when ready.
Your Honor, Patrick LeGray Forn on behalf of the appellant, Jonathan Ortner. Again, Patrick LeGray on behalf of the appellant. In this particular case, the appellant argues that in fact the trial court did not make a just and equitable division of the marital property pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518.561. I'd like to begin by addressing what begins on page 23 of the appellant's brief that deals with the trial court's award of $400,851.24 within 30 days of entry of the judgment. Of that amount, $325,282.25 is attributed to the stock in a holding company named Oculus. And in that particular case, as far as the principals in the business, both the appellant and the respondent were both vice presidents. So they certainly had comparable knowledge with regard to everything as far as the business concerns and how the business transacted its various concerns, raised money, et cetera. The appellant states that, in fact, the award was clearly erroneous for a couple of reasons. First of all, the testimony was that the Oculus stock in approximately 2014 was owned 50-50 between the appellant and his brother, Mr. Kevin Ortner, who was also a principal in the corporations. And that subsequent to that, based upon the fact that their father had contributed $120,000 to the business and the fact that they needed to rearrange who would be in control of the businesses for purposes of refinancing and retooling a number of businesses, all of the stock was transferred into the name of the appellant. And this transfer was in fact effective for approximately 1 year, and then it reverted back to the agreement that they had with their father, whereas the father, for his capital investment of approximately $120,000, would be awarded 50% of the stock, and then the appellant would have 25%, and the appellant's brother would have 25%. This is borne out by the testimony and the exhibits.
I understand that's your argument, and that was the testimony of your clients, Mr. Dre, but the district court rejected all that. The district court made credibility determinations that it didn't believe that evidence, that it thought that this was a fraudulent scheme. I think that's really where we need to focus, because the district court can make those credibility determinations. And so I think from your perspective, other than credibility determinations, how did the court err in making that finding? Because if it didn't, everybody agrees at the time the dissolution was filed, your client owned 100% of that stock.
That's what the trial court found. But my argument would be that, in fact, the trial court then failed to apply the Nardini standard. In the state Supreme Court from Minnesota, in Nardini versus Nardini, which was a dissolution of marriage case at 414 Northwest Reporters 2nd, beginning at page 184, and this is referred to in the respondent's brief, and it is not referred to in the appellant's brief. But I think that based upon your concerns, the court found in that.
So what is the Nardini standard? You haven't cited it in your brief. If you're going to rely on it as a basis to reverse, could you tell us what that standard is?
Yes, I will. And that is, in fact, when there is a closely held corporation and the parties cannot agree on the division of that entity, there are three things that the court can do. One is they can do what the appellant in this case requested, and that is simply take the stock and divide it in half, given each half, and based upon their relatively equal standings in this corporation, they'd have the equal opportunity.
Does the Nardini case say the district court must do that?
No, and in fact, it gives three things that the court can do. The second thing they can do, they can order the sale or liquidation of the corporation and divide the proceeds. Or the third thing they can do, which was done in this case, the court can award the asset, such as the stock or the units in an LLC, to one party and then order payment of an amount. But in order to order the payment, what the court found was that the forced sale by one spouse to another has the greatest potential for error and unfairness, particularly when the asset is the major marital asset, which it was in this case.
Did the district court in this case order the sale, forced sale of the stock?
It basically awarded the stock to my client and then told my client he had to pay in excess of $300,000, which would be...
But the district court didn't tell your client he had to sell the stock.
That's correct, but he also didn't have any assets. But in the Nardini case, what the court did was they laid out eight factors that the trial court has to follow if they're going to give the stock to one party and give cash to the other.
Were there findings in Nardini that one party engaged in fraudulent conduct?
No.
Doesn't that distinguish these circumstances from Nardini?
I don't think it does, because let's say that the fraud is what awarded to the respondent 100% of the stock. So then the question is, how do we evaluate this pot of 100% of the stock? And again, in Nardini, what the state Supreme Court said was there's eight factors, and none of these factors, in fact, were addressed by the trial court when it made the award.
Did you raise Nardini or these factors?
No, because our argument was there should be a stock split, and it was the respondent's position, apparently, based upon their submitted proposed findings, that in fact it would be a cash award. But in doing so, there was no basis at the trial court for an award, because none of the eight factors were followed. The nature of the business and the history of the enterprise from its inception wasn't gone into. The economic outlook in general and the condition and outlook of the specific industry in particular was never gone into. The book value of the stock and the financial condition of the business was never testified to.
I thought the brother testified the stock was worth $1.70 a share.
That was what is referred to as the book value. But again, that's only one of the two tests in item number three of the Nardini case, only one of the two factors that goes into factor number three. And then, of course, the earning capacity of the company, the dividend-paying capacity, whether or not the enterprise has goodwill or other intangible value, the sales of the stock and the size of the block of the stock to be valued, and the market price of stocks or corporations engaged in the same or a similar line of business having their stocks traded in a free and open market. Again, in this particular case, none of those factors were addressed at the trial court level, and arguably from the appellant standpoint, if in fact the respondent wanted to get cash value, it was their obligation to put that forward. Our obligation was to demonstrate the number of shares of stock that there were, make the argument that in fact the appellant only owed 25%, which was rejected by the court based upon fraud, misrepresentations, or whatever. But when we even look at that particular issue, the question is then, if they in fact did this fraudulently for a period of 1 year, and it wasn't for that purpose, and they were going to invest in fraud, why wouldn't they have just done a document from the various inception and never admitted that in fact the two brothers owned it 50-50? There was no testimony by anyone saying that in fact, Jonathan Ortner owed 100% of the stock from the inception of this LLC. There was never any testimony. It was all based upon conjecture of the respondent. Now, the court has wide latitude and, of course, can take into consideration the demeanor of the witnesses before them, their truthfulness. But in this particular case, all of the principal investors in this company, all three of them, told a consistent story about who owned what stock and when and explained the reasons why.
I might be missing something here, but the book value is $1.70, and that testimony goes in evidence. The court wants to equalize the property. The court also can see the problems in keeping the wife involved with the husband, the brother, and the father who can run the company. She's entangled in that with them. They can make moves to control the company so that a stock award to her is in somewhat in jeopardy. It seems to me the court made a clean break of it and had a basis for doing so.
Again, I would argue that the court didn't follow the requirements of the state Supreme Court in Nardini.
Counsel, I just want to make sure I'm clear where we're at procedurally. You're here now arguing that we should reverse because the district court didn't apply certain factors in Nardini.
Correct.
You did not argue those factors in district court.
No, because our assumption was that we would be awarded half of the stock.
Then you weren't awarded half the stock.
No.
You appealed. You filed a brief. Nowhere in your brief do you mention Nardini or the argument that we should reverse because the district court failed to apply those factors.
That's correct.
And respondent cited Nardini once in the brief to simply say there are three options when dividing a closely held corporation. From that, you didn't file a response brief notifying the court or the opposition that you were going to raise this Nardini issue and failure to analyze factors. Instead, you're raising that for the first time in oral argument when no one in the room has had an opportunity to read that case or prepare for argument.
That's correct. And
are you aware that we do have certain rules, such as we won't consider arguments that weren't raised below, we won't consider arguments that weren't raised in the brief, we won't consider arguments raised for the first time in a reply brief, and the reason we have those rules is so everybody understands what the issues are and everybody has an opportunity to address them.
I understand, and I thought it would be inappropriate to do a response brief with that because the issue was out there with regard to, and I would just be adding something I didn't think was appropriate for a reply brief.
Why do you think it's appropriate to come to the court and make the arguments orally without giving anyone any notice?
I felt that within the context of the appellate brief that, in fact, it was addressed. And that, in fact, that I raised the abuse of discretion for the award and for the dollar amount. But you're absolutely right. It wasn't raised in my appellate brief, and I didn't do a response brief because I thought it came within the issues and wouldn't be appropriate for a response brief.
Understood.
And then with regard to the other issues, basically, we're arguing, in fact, that the trial court erred in saying that there was no evidence presented. I was looking for the time clock. Is there? Oh, I'm sorry. That in fact, the trial court found with regard to a number of issues that there was no evidence. And the appellant contends that, in fact, testimony and the exhibits received after foundation were, in fact, evidence. And so the trial court didn't say, having weighed the credible and non-credible evidence and this, that, and the other thing, it simply said that there was no evidence and then made findings with regard to its statement that, in fact, there should be no offset, there should be no payment from the home sale back to the respondent's father, in spite of the fact his testimony was he had put approximately $30,000 into mortgage payments, et cetera. And interestingly, only he and respondent were, in fact, went to the closing because my client, the appellant's credit rating and his employment history wouldn't allow him to be a primary signator on those documents. And so it's the same argument that we have with regard to a number of issues. The loans made to the appellant and the appellant's testimony that he used those loans for marital expenses with regard to loans that he received from a number of people. One, his father, in the amount of $30,000.
But the court found there was no documentation, no note, correct?
That's exactly right. And I would argue, and so that when it comes to the property sale, you can't then, without a document filed on it, get at the closing that amount of money. But nevertheless, appellant would argue that, in fact, that doesn't prohibit him from having a claim against the funds that were deposited into trust.
But doesn't the district court's finding that there was no documentation of this loan tell us that the district court didn't believe your client again on this issue?
I guess we can make that assumption.
Well, case law indicates we often make assumptions, even though there's no express credibility determination, it can be implicit. I mean, for example, you're right, the district court says throughout that there is no evidence of this or no evidence of that. However, the evidence you're citing to refute the district court's finding is also described by the district court in his findings. So it does seem like for the district court to say, here's all the testimony from husband, there's no evidence to show, seems more like a rejection of that testimony and an implicit credibility determination, doesn't it? As opposed to the district court really didn't recognize that there was evidence.
I agree. And I think you can make the logical assumption, but for the purpose of appellate review and addressing similar cases, it would be nice to have specific findings.
All right, counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can address that.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Erin Kirby McLean, and I represent the respondent, Margaret Blanchard, formerly Margaret Ortner, the wife in this case. First, in my brief, I already went through many of the misrepresentations from appellant, but I wanted to take a few moments to discuss a few that were just brought up. The first is Oculus, the entity of Oculus. Was actually formed, I believe, in 2006, 2007, many years ago. That company then was used for several things, and there was testimony from both Ortner brothers that it was used for various business opportunities, and then it ended up having a franchise of Renters Warehouse Rochester. And then in 2015, Renters Warehouse contacted the Ortners and wanted to purchase the franchise back in exchange. There were shares given and various other things. It was as part of a whole restructuring, I guess is what I would consider it, between companies owned by the Ortner brothers. And the purpose of that was so that the husband here would end up with one company, and he would be able to own 100% of the shares of that company. The appellant has argued that it was not for that purpose, but there are text messages between the husband and husband's brother saying, "Have you signed the divorce papers yet?" Indicating the documents that weren't signed until 2017, after the appellant had already filed for divorce. Second, in Nardini, the court found that it was an unlikely choice if the corporation is closely held to separate the shares. In this context, it's not only that Oculus is owned by husband, but the shares that Oculus owns are Renters Warehouse shares. And the brother, the husband's brother, is the CEO of that company and does have great control over the value, over the shares, over many items that would impact the value. So it wouldn't make sense for the court to have separated the shares here. And there were 9 issues brought up by appellant in his brief, and I wanted to just briefly touch on number 3 and number 7. Number 3 is the percentage ownership of Oculus, and number 7 is the cash property settlement. In number 3, the 100% ownership of Oculus, the court found that there was no evidence. We argue that this is a shorthand that he used throughout, that he did mention in his findings evidence that that was brought up by appellant, but ended up deciding that it wasn't credible or not reliable to make his decision upon. In fact, there was no credible evidence of anything other than the fact that husband owned 100% of Oculus. The standard of review and a finding of fact is clearly erroneous. I believe appellant said that it was abuse of discretion, but it is a finding of fact, so it's clearly erroneous. The court had evidence to show that the husband is a spendthrift, that the husband's father and husband's brother had, throughout husband's adulthood, had protected him from his financial dishonesty. One example that was just given was the father ended up co-signing on the home because husband wasn't able to do so. There was a shell game that was intended to reduce the marital estate and accordingly reduce my client's share of the marital estate. He, without consideration after filing for divorce, transferred 75% of a business out of his name and out of the marital estate. And that would have reduced my client's marital share by over $300,000. For number seven, the cash property settlement, the court in attachment A went through all of the assets that the parties had and gave values for each. In the proposed findings that we prepared, we cited to the record for each of those items, and it is completely backed up by the evidence that was in the record. It is very common for courts to put values on everything. They don't make the parties sell their house and split it in half. They don't make them sell all the cars and split them in half. They put a value on them and then put them on a balance sheet and then equalize the marital estate, and that's what the court did.
Was the court required to consider an ability to pay $400,000 within 30 days? And if so, did its findings reflect that?
I don't believe that the court needed to consider that, Your Honor. The court found that he had lots of businesses and business assets at his disposal and gave 30 days to do that. To date, he has not paid anything, and I understand that's not in the record, but nothing has been paid to my client, not a nickel of it.
Well, the argument was, though, that 300 and some thousand of the 400,000 had to do with this Oculus stock, that was valued at $1.70 a share. But I didn't see anything in the record that indicated, and you can correct me, obviously, that indicated how that stock could be liquidated.
There are many documents in the record about the in 2016 when the restructuring occurred of Renters Warehouse, where it was purchasing back the franchises. There are documents in that contain an ability to sell some of those shares. But I don't believe the court is required to say how it would be paid. That's why it's a cash equalizer payment. He could go with the collateral of the business and get a loan. He could contact his brother and father and talk about selling some of the assets that Illuminated Investments own. There are many ways that he could have figured that out on his own. I don't believe that the court is required to say you will sell X to be able to pay Y. He left it up to the appellant to do so, to make that decision.
Didn't the court say that it would be reduced to judgment if it wasn't paid? So has that happened at this point? Your client has a judgment?
Yes, Your Honor. But in the pendency of an appeal, she's not able to collect on that judgment. This case has been going on. I believe he served her in the fall or early winter of 2016. So years have occurred now with...
Point is this. The argument is, as I understand it, the district court didn't consider that 30 days wasn't enough time for me to pay this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's reduced to judgment, now you have all the time in the world. I'm having a hard time understanding where the harm is, I guess.
Thank you, Your Honor. I I agree with
However, I am curious about the attorney fees of $19,000. That seems pretty slim support in the findings. What can you tell us about those?
The court did find that there was an attempt to provide incomplete or misleading information. Over $90,000 in attorney's fees was shown to the court regarding the fees for respondent. And he went through and discerned that it was just the discovery and the depositions because of the lack of candor from the appellant for those $19,000 in attorney's fees. I believe that they are completely reasonable. These conduct-based attorney's fees are discretionary at the trial court, and the court continually saw the self-serving testimony, the lack of information that was provided to my client throughout.
And I know you say the judge saw that, but does the judge explain that to us in his findings so that we understand what went on and whether or not it justifies a $19,000 conduct-based award?
The court did make the express finding that there was an attempt to provide the incomplete information and then
but no examples.
Correct.
To kind of give us a sense.
Correct. Not in that finding, but in the order, he did say that there was a fraudulent attempt to transfer a lot of money out of the marital estate and dissipate that marital estate. So I think when looking at the other pieces of the order and the subsequent attorney's fees order, both of those show that there was
Were there motions to compel discovery that the district court had to preside over that your client had to bring during this litigation?
There were not, Your Honor. Instead, what we did is we went through the informal discovery process. We went through the formal discovery process. We received documents. We had conversations with the court via telephone, so it wasn't...
The question I have is, how does the district court, you know, the district court makes this blanket statement. You know, he wasn't forthcoming, there was delay, he wasn't providing the information. How does the district court know that if those issues weren't brought to the district court's attention in a motion to compel and we have some sort of record to look at to document it?
Instead of going forward with a motion to compel, what we decided to do was move forward with depositions to attempt to receive the information in another way because we thought that because the depositions were likely going to need to happen anyways in an attempt to reduce the costs.
Well, if the depositions are going to need to happen anyway, how was there any increased costs from failure to make disclosures that were ultimately made in depositions?
I'm sorry, I misspoke, but we thought that the better path was to move forward with the depositions because it would be a lower cost, and we could potentially also need the deposition if the motion to compel didn't work out in our favor. And there were documents given, but between when it was filed and when discovery occurred, there was manipulation of the documents, which wasn't seen until the trial, but the court was able to see that there was manipulation of the value of Oculus and the other companies that led to the expense. So we brought it into trial, and it wasn't brought in a subsequent motion, Your Honor. To continue on that with the attorney's fees and the fraudulent approach to this case that the appellant took, when looking at things like the corporate minutes of Oculus, Tatanka, and Illuminated Investments, there are many examples of what they were trying to do by reducing the marital estate. For example, the minutes indicate that there was that. The minutes indicate that they wanted to speak with Mr. LeDray about how to protect their assets in the case of the divorce. And I believe that the court ended up rejecting the self-serving testimony of the husband, husband's brother, and husband's father. They rejected the lead testimony of the memory impaired and easily led father, and they rejected the fraudulently and backdated corporate documents where the husband transferred 75% of Oculus out of husband's name with zero consideration. It's time to end the husband's fraud, delay, disrespect, and irresponsibility. The wife respectfully requests that this panel affirm the court's order in its entirety, and I stand ready to answer any other questions that the panel may have.
No. No, that's it, counsel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, and I appreciate the panel's indulgence. I would like to just address the award of attorney's fees. And even in the court's order, even states in paragraph 8, this is an uncertain task. It cannot be done with sharp-edged scalpel. It is certain that the entries the court has identified as compensable may include some time that would not be considered conduct-based if a full explanation and examination were possible. In this particular case, my client, the appellant, was not the best record keeper. I would say that there were probably in excess of 15 to 20,000 pages provided through the discovery process, some which took longer than is normally allowed if motions are brought. I would argue that he brought them forward at the earliest opportunity and that there was an opportunity to conduct oral examination through deposition testimony. And the award of conduct-based attorney's fees, I think, requires some specificity, which is lacking in this case. Quite frankly, the appellant in remanding the case gives arguably the respondent an opportunity to go back and redo the records, et cetera. And in this particular case, though, having reviewed everything that was done and the motions that were and were not brought, it's the appellant's belief that the conduct based award of $19,140.84, it wasn't warranted. Then with regard to the issue of who owned what stock when.
Well, let me just get back to the attorney fee question, though, because the fraud that the court found here wasn't just a fraud on the parties. This was a fraud that the court found occurred after the filing of a dissolution action. That's a fraud on the court. And it would seem to me that it would naturally follow that when you commit a fraud on the court, there's going to be some penalty for that. And it would be reasonable for a district court to impose a conduct-based attorney fee award, because I don't know how that wouldn't add to the cost of the litigation by committing such a fraud after you've commenced an action, which is what the court found here. So how? Maybe we can quibble about the amounts and how the judge came up with them, but it seems to me that when you commit a fraud on the court, there's going to be consequences for that. And normally in the context of a civil action, those are going to be attorney fee consequences that resulted from the commission of that fraud. Are we talking about 19,000 is the wrong figure? Or is it your position there should be no conduct-based attorney's fees?
Well, arguably, I think that there probably should be some, but it would be a minimal amount. And, for example, when counsel requested documents and then had to rewrite letters requesting those same documents, which in the end were provided, in spite of the fact she didn't bring motion, I think that there is an argument to be made that her client incurred expenses for the second letter and that could be compensable. But there's not that type of articulation in the court's order for attorney's fees. And then with regard to the whole thing of the court's finding fraud and misrepresentation by the appellant. It was never anything that was hidden. The appellant's position was he owned 50-50 of Oculus with his brother. The father kicks in $120,000. The brother makes a capital investment of $20,000-$25,000. My client, the appellant, has no money to put in, but nevertheless, they give him 25%. Then he gets all of the 100% for the purpose of negotiations. There was also, I believe, testimony that the brother got 100% of another entity. When that's all done, they go back to the agreement that they made with their father, which was an oral agreement, which appellant argues is still a contract in Minnesota, and it went back to the original agreement based upon their financial contribution. The court never addressed the financial contribution and found fraud, which it has the right to do, but we feel that it was an abuse of discretion.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. The matter is taken under advisement. Opinion will issue within 90 days. We will adjourn now until 11:15 for the next case.